Clinton administration, is that they wanted the anniversary of the Good Friday Agreement to be celebrated in the North and in America and everywhere else as a peace deal that President Biden himself had brought about or helped to bring about. Now, that hasn't worked. And Biden must be very disappointed that it hasn't worked, because there isn't a reconstituted administration in Belfast, a power-sharing administration with a nationalist and unionist serving in the same government. That has not happened. Now, the way the powers that be, sort of in Ireland and Britain and America, all sort of expected things to happen, is that we would have a deal, that the deal would have been signed just within the last week. And this would have happened with great pomp and panoply, that we'd have all the parties signing up with Joe Biden in the middle of them, and then peace at last in Northern Ireland being declared. That would have been a huge public relations coup, triumph for Mr. Biden. But what happened, of course, is that all the parties are not serving together, because under the peculiar arrangements established by the Good Friday Agreement itself, each side, Protestant Unionists and Catholic Nationalists, each side has a veto over what might happen. And the Democratic Unionist Party has decided to exercise its veto, so the whole process cannot go forward. This must be a bitter disappointment to those in America and in Ireland who were expecting unrestrained celebration. Mr. Biden must have been expecting unrestrained celebration with himself at the centre of it. It hasn't happened, and we don't think it's going to happen anytime soon.
And Amy, could you talk a little bit about what is the cause of the current deadlock among the various parties? And also, how do you see Brexit as a threat to building peace in Northern Ireland?
Well, Brexit is certainly a factor, but there's many other factors as well. And somebody once said about the Irish problem, you know, it's a very simple problem, but impossible to understand. Brexit threatens to erect a border between Northern Ireland and Southern Ireland, or alternatively, a border right down the Irish Sea, separating the whole of Ireland, Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland, separating the whole of Ireland from the United Kingdom. Now, that's an immediate implication for the question of partition in Ireland, because if you have trade barriers between Northern Ireland and the United Kingdom, then you have threatened the integrity of the United Kingdom, no matter what way you construe it. That is sort of a loosening or lessening sort of the bonds between Northern Ireland and the United Kingdom. It is, to some extent, both symbolically and a little bit in substance, it is detaching Northern Ireland from the United Kingdom and putting it into a position which is closer to that of the Irish Republic. Now, for those who want to see a transition to an Irish Republic, that's terrific. That's terrific. For those like the Unionist Party, the Democratic Unionist Party in Northern Ireland, that's absolutely anathema. So here you have, once again, in 2023, you have the old Irish question come to the fore again. But Churchill once calls this, after the war, the tide of a battle recedes. And when we look, what we see are the dreary steeples of Fermanagh and Tyrone rising above the surface again. We are witnessing that today.
And what about this proposed bill by the British government, the Northern Ireland Troubles Legacy and Reconciliation Bill? What is it, and what's been the reaction by various interest groups in Ireland and in Northern Ireland?
Well, the Troubles Bill is a unique bill. You know, we're talking about division, and the Troubles were a reflection of the division, but the British Troubles Bill has had the marvellous result of uniting every party in Northern Ireland. They're from vivid green to deep-dyed orange. They are all united and say they don't want this bill. And the reason why they're all united is that the bill, that in effect, would amnesty all those over recent years who have committed crimes in connection with the Troubles. That's putting it very simply, but that's what it means. And, of course, Catholic nationalists in Ireland saying, we are not having that, because we had Bloody Sunday, we had Bloody Friday, we have a long history over this last 25 years of violence and no justice for the victims. Now, at the same time, you know, if you're a Protestant Unionist in Northern Ireland, you can't say, wait a minute, if we implement this, everybody who did every IRA atrocity, as they would see it, is now forgiven. So we have no recourse. Now, that dissatisfies everybody, and that lies behind the fact that, as I said a couple of minutes ago, there is a unity against this bill, which one that you could say is a shining light for Northern Ireland, everybody working together. That's everybody working together to refuse the amnesty bill, which the Conservative government in London is absolutely insisting on imposing upon people. Very briefly in a sentence, the reason why the Conservatives, of course, are imposing this is that the Conservatives do not want their old soldiers who have been guilty of atrocities in Northern Ireland to be held to account, to be brought before a court, to be given the same treatment as the British government would like to give to terrorists, as they say. So this is what a tangled web we have woven, as Shakespeare might put it.
Well, Eamon McCann, we want to thank you so much for being with us, journalist, writer, activist in Derry, Northern Ireland. Next up, it's day 5 of the first faculty strike in Rutgers University's 257-year history. We'll speak with one of the professors on strike. Stay with us. Strikers singing to the tune of Hey Baby by Bruce Channel. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We go now to New Jersey, where faculty at the state-run Rutgers University have entered their 5th day of a strike. This is the first faculty strike in Rutgers' 257-year history. It's being organized by 3 unions that represent more than 9,000 professors, lecturers, graduate assistants, and researchers at Rutgers' 3 campuses in New Brunswick, Newark, and Camden. They're demanding increased pay and better job security, especially for poorly paid graduate workers and adjunct faculty. We're joined now by Donna Murch, an associate professor of history at Rutgers University and New Brunswick chapter president of Rutgers AUPAFT, one of the academic workers' unions on strike. Professor Murch, welcome back to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us. Can you lay out what exactly is at issue here? And also, when you go to the Rutgers website, it says it's business as usual. People should go to class. Yet this is the first strike in 257 years involving—and it involves thousands and thousands of workers there.
Thank you so much, Amy. It's a pleasure to be here and to talk about what's going on at Rutgers, which is very exciting. So I would say the core issues that brought the union coalition together, they are very connected to what happened to the university during the pandemic. So Rutgers' response to the pandemic was to lay off 5% of its workforce. And when it laid them off, they lost their health insurance and their tuition benefits at a time when COVID was hitting New Jersey and New York like a storm. That necessitated that the unions come together and begin to bargain and to think of themselves as really a wall-to-wall coalition. So that history is very important, and it's brought us to this point in which three unions have gone on strike, and the core issues are, number one, the way in which the central administration, upper management, has been growing and growing and really siphoning money off of the core needs of the university. So what we are calling for in this moment of runaway inflation is for the Rutgers management to come to the table and really think about what the university is for: teaching, research, and service to our communities. So the core demands are, one, a living wage, equal pay for equal work for adjunct workers. So you have adjuncts who are being paid starvation wages, many of whom are on Medicaid, who can't afford rent and food and all the essentials of life. And this, at the heart of the strike, is really trying to change a university which is dependent on sweated informal labor, where they have to apply for their contracts every 6 months and have to teach at multiple institutions just to cobble together the bare minimum. So a fight to think about adjuncts, postdocs, graduate workers, EOF counselors, contingent, non-tenure track, full-time faculty, as well as tenure stream. And I mention all those job categories because this industrial vision is about holding up the different job categories, figuring out how they come together, and they work in solidarity. In terms of Rutgers saying on its website, business as usual, well, that is not true. Our estimates are that 70% of the classes are shut down, and because of the broad wall-to-wall nature of the strike, even construction workers on campus have walked off the job so as not to violate the picket lines. So I think one of the things that has been also really profound is the outpouring of support and participation by the undergraduates. There have been thousands and thousands of people out in the street, and significant numbers are undergraduates, graduate workers, as well as other people from the three unions. So I've taught at Rutgers for 20 years, and this is the biggest popular gathering that I've seen. And there were so many people on Monday after we had a rally. It was on Tuesday that they led a march that shut down George Street, which is the main drag in New Brunswick.
Don, I wanted to ask you, this has become almost the spring of academic revolts around the country. We've seen strikes in the University of California. We've seen University of Illinois, Chicago, and right now there are three other universities in the Chicago area that are on strike: Chicago State University, Eastern Illinois, and Governor State University, with thousands of faculty there. And yet many of these universities, like Rutgers, are experiencing they don't call it profits, they call it surpluses or reserves over the past few years. How do you explain this, the universities being flush with cash, yet being telling their faculty and their employees that there's not enough money to give them adequate raises?
Yeah, thank you so much for that, Juan. We miss you at Rutgers. It's good to be here with you. That is extremely important, and I can talk about, through the lens of Rutgers, how this links to this national movement. So the Rutgers administration has been crying broke, and their justification for not responding to demands is that they simply don't have the money. And our union hired a forensic accountant to go through all of the public records. Because Rutgers is a public university, it is subject to transparency requirements. And Howard Bunces, his research demonstrates very clearly that the university has the largest unrestricted reserves in its history. It's up to $886 million. And these are the rainy day funds that are being used, that are normally used in times of, you know, downturn or to meet the essential needs of its workers. The way I explain this is that it's where I started. The neoliberal university, which has been literally the upper level administration, is metastasizing. They've doubled in size over the past 10 years, and they're constantly hiring different vice presidents of this, vice presidents of that, largely accountants and MBAs who have no experience in higher education. And I really think it is a question of distribution. It is true that in the last 30 years, there has been a defunding of higher education from the federal government and from state government. But at Rutgers, we've been able to win really important concessions, including our lobbying, the lobbying of the union, which won back a significant portion of Rutgers funding in 2020. But there's really no correspondence that I can see between them having large unrestricted reserves and their labor policies. I think that it grows out of an idea that they want labor to be as cheap as possible, and that it's really the people at the very top who benefit from the university. So I think that at its core, this is a political and an economic struggle to say tuition, the students are largely funding the university, their needs matter, that the faculty, the graduate students, the graduate workers, the many different categories of workers that come together to make the university possible, they matter. We make Rutgers.
And also, the current president of Rutgers, Jonathan Holloway, was a respected scholar, historic in history and African American studies. He always talks about having a beloved community, but he's been threatening to go to court to get to seek an injunction against the strike.
Yeah, thank you. This is such an important piece. And I'll just say we're going through incredibly intense negotiations right now. A lot of us have been up all night working on this, figuring out what to do. And we are under injunction threat. And I'll talk a little bit more later about what's going on in Trenton today and how you can help. But we started bargaining. Our contract was up at the end of June 2022. And we had started bargaining in May. Many times the university did not come to the table at all. They did not bargain in earnest. They refused to respond to our counterproposals. I think the most shocking one of those is that the grads submitted their proposal for a living wage, and they failed to respond to that for 7-8 months. We're only now beginning to have even a substantive discussion about moving grads to livable wages. So these resistance tactics have been going on all along. When it became clear that bargaining was not going well and was breaking down and that the union was mobilizing, Jonathan Holloway sent a letter to all of the different parts of our bargaining unit and through Rutgers email and all of the undergraduates saying that public sector strikes in New Jersey are illegal, and that those that participate in them are subject to fines, not only of the individual union, but individual fines and facing threat of arrest. And there was another email sent several weeks later doubling down on this. And he was sending a clear message that we will go to the courts to criminalize the strike. I want to say something about the technicalities of this because it's extremely important. Public sector strikes are not illegal in New Jersey. If you go on strike, the police do not arrest you. The only way criminalization happens is that the employer goes to a court. They have one hearing. They ask for an injunction. Usually it entails a cease and desist order. And then they go back to the workers and see if they're willing to cease and desist. And if not, then they go back. So Jonathan Holloway will go back to the courts to seek penalties. And he will ask for specific penalties, and there will be a hearing. These have been granted, but they have not been granted in all cases. So that's very important, the mechanisms of the injunction, that it has to be sought by the employer, which is a clear sign that Jonathan Holloway, you know, at a time where we've seen the, you know, largest protest in American history around issues of criminalization, is willing to criminalize a strike in a deep blue state like New Jersey. So this has enormous consequences for labor. And that helps to explain the incredible coalition that's come together. There are thousands of people there, all the people that I talked about, the undergraduates, but also people coming from labor unions all over the country, the New Jersey AFL-CIO, Central Labor Councils from all over New Jersey, because everyone is recognizing that we have a Democratic governor, and Rutgers is one of the largest employers, and the threat to break the strike is really a threat, not only to all of us at Rutgers, but to New Jersey and the rest of the country at this moment when we're seeing this incredible surge in higher education organizing. And I have to give a shout out to grad organizing all over the country. I, too, was a UC grad in the 1990s when we organized the union. And I think the graduate students have shown us what's possible.
Well, Donna Murch, I want to thank you for being with us, Associate Professor of History at Rutgers University and New Brunswick Chapter President of Rutgers AAUP-AFT, one of the academic workers unions now on strike. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez, who's taught at Rutgers for the past 7 years. But we end today's show looking at U.S. policy toward Cuba. As high-level U.S. and Cuban officials met Wednesday to discuss migration from Cuba. This comes after the U.S. Embassy in Havana started to process immigrant visas in January for the first time since 2017. It also comes as the Biden administration faces increasing calls to lift its designation of Cuba as a state sponsor of terrorism and also the related embargo that severely limited trade and more with Cuba for decades. For more, we're joined by Liz Oliva Fernandez, award-winning Cuban journalist with the independent media organization Belly of the Beast, based in Cuba, but on tour here in the United States for screenings and events with director Reed Lindsay. They're starting to work on a new documentary looking into the economic and political interests driving Cuba policy under President Biden. Welcome to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us, Liz. If you can start off by talking about the significance of these negotiations that are not getting very much attention between Cuba and Washington that are happening this week here.
Well, first, thank you, Amy, for having me in this program. Well, of course, that right now, United States open to talk about with Cuba about migration, because you need to know that this is not only sanctions that you are putting against a country. This is economic warfare that the United States is playing with Cuba. So right now, this is having an effect, boomerang effect in the U.S., because a lot of people from Cuba are coming to the United States. But they are not coming from us political refugees. They are coming to the United States as economical refugees, because the situation in Cuba is pretty bad. So that's something that United States government, the Biden administration, is facing right now.
And in terms of the historic policy of the United States of allowing people to be process normal visas through Cuba, what has been the policy in the past?
Well, they have policies to visa for migrants, like a family reunification, they call it. But this is not something that they are doing. They have to process like 20,000 migration visas at a year, and they never did that. They never backed that numbers. They never fooled that numbers, because the politics is trying to get the people in the United States, but it's not about a normal, a regular process, because when you have this kind of law, like adjustment law, they are giving privilege to Cuba in order to come to the United States as refugees. But they say it all the time that it's about political refugees that are coming to Cuba, and that's wrong. That's inaccurate, because when the most of the people who come to this country from Cuba, they are coming as economical refugees, as I already said, because this is not something that is like from the last year or the 10 last year. This is something that is coming from the 60s. So, for example, I have been in crisis my entire life my mom have living crisis in my entire life. The biggest cause of this crisis is the sanctions that the United States put in against Cuba, is weighing against my country. That's the result. That's the consequence. So maybe instead of talking about migration, I'd rather that the United States and my government have conversations about what is causing this migration, what is causing this wave, the huge wave in the last year with migration. The cause is the sanctions. So maybe in the future, the United States government and Biden administration have the will to talk about the real cause of these migrations.
And I wanted to ask you, as a journalist, you interviewed Elian Gonzalez, the Cuban national who was at the center of an international custody battle as a child back in 1999. That's a quarter century ago. I remember going to Miami, covering the protests of the Cuban exile community there, insisting that Elian stay here in the United States. But the Clinton administration returned him to Cuba, and he became a member of the Cuban Assembly. Could you talk about of the National Assembly? Could you talk about your interview with him?
Yeah, of course. I have the privilege to have this interview with Elian Gonzalez. He's pretty glad to have a life in Cuba. Now he's playing like a biggest role because he's really political active, because he recently formed part of the Cuban Assembly. So he's really open to trying to do help from his seat in the National Assembly in Cuba to try to get to the point to the Obama normalization province. Normalizations between Cuba and the United States, he is willing to try to get a better relationship between two countries because he really believes that there is a better future for us, a future when people from the United States can have, like, normalized relationships.
Liz Oliva Fernandez, we don't have much time, but I wanted to ask you about this designation by the U.S. government of Cuba as a state sponsor of terrorism and the effect that that has, especially as Biden was vice president to Obama, under Obama, who normalized relations before Trump took that back.
Yeah, well, this state sponsor of terrorism list is like a death sentence for Cuba because nobody wants to do business with terrorists. So Cuba is not allowed to get credit, to get like people coming to my country to investment because nobody wants to be related with it. A country that is called like a terrorist. And this is, for me, is really cynical and really hypocritical because Cuba is not only open to the terrorists. There's not only no financing terrorist attacks or acts around the world. It's also a victim of terrorist attack. For example, before September 11, Cuba was suffered the biggest terrorist attacks in the Western Hemisphere, and that's really bad because the people who perpetrated this attack had been living freely in the United States until their deaths. Cuba doesn't have its own terrorist list, sponsored state of terrorism, but if we have this privilege that the United States has, like you are a terrorist and you are a terrorist, if Cuba had that kind of privilege, we can make like United States the first name in that list.
We want to thank you so much for being with us, Liz Oliva Fernandez, award-winning Cuban journalist with Belly of the Beast, now touring the United States, a journalist in Cuba. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is currently accepting applications for a digital fellow. Learn more and apply at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Produced with Renee Fels, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warnock, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Are you inspired? Do you want to be? Tune in to The Arts Edge with Annie Roach, Saturdays from 6 to 7 p.m. and hear stories of artists and educators, writers, painters, actors, people from all walks of life. Hear how people are making their lives happen. You can find us at CJSF 90.1 FM, Burnaby Mountain. We're at TELUS HD Channel 7014. Or you can find us on the internet at www.cjsf.ca. Tune in to The Arts Edge and be inspired.
Thank you for listening.